The place was bright, and I marked that down in its favor. I have an intense dislike for dark restaurants where you can't see what you're eating or drinking. The walls were white and hung with vibrant, impressionist drawings. You couldn't tell what they were, but that didn't matter. With their primary colors and broad, exuberant strokes, they hit your eyes like visual caffeine. I looked for Diane and saw a woman that might have been her, seated about halfway down the long room and by the wall. It was hard to say because her back was turned, and I don't have her knack of recognition under difficult circumstances. But the heavy-set, balding man she was sitting with certainly looked like a Humboldt. I took a deep breath, opened the restaurant door, and went in. There are two phases of withdrawal from tobacco, and I'm convinced that it's the second that causes most cases of recidivism. The physical withdrawal lasts 10 days to 2 weeks, and then most of the symptoms, sweats, headaches, muscle twitches, pounding eyes, insomnia, irritability, disappear. What follows is a much longer period of mental withdrawal. These symptoms may include mild to moderate depression, mourning, some degree of anhedonia, emotional flatness, in other words, forgetfulness, even a species of transient dyslexia. I know all this stuff because I read up on it. Following what happened at the Gotham Cafe, it seemed very important that I do that. I suppose you'd have to say that my interest in the subject fell somewhere between the land of hobbies and the kingdom of obsession. The most common symptom of phase two withdrawal is a feeling of mild unreality. Nicotine improves synaptic transferal and improves concentration, widens the brain's information highway, in other words. It's not a big boost, and not really necessary to successful thinking, although most confirmed cigarette junkies believe differently. But when you take it away, you're left with a feeling, a pervasive feeling in my case, that the world has taken on a decidedly dreamy cast. It was also a little like being mildly stoned all the time, because the feeling was accompanied by a sense of helplessness and moral exhaustion. A feeling that things had to simply go on the way they were going, for good or for ill, because you, except of course it's me I'm talking about, were just too damn busy not smoking to do much of anything else. I'm not sure how much all of this bears on what happened, but I know it has some bearing, because I was pretty sure something was wrong with the maitre d' almost as soon as I saw him, and as soon as he spoke to me, I knew. He was tall, maybe 45, slim, in his tux at least, in ordinary clothes he would have been skinny, mustached. He had a leather-bound menu in one hand. He looked like battalions of maitre d's and battalions of fancy New York restaurants, in other words. Except for his bow tie, which was askew, and something on his shirt, a splotch just above the place where his jacket buttoned. It looked like either gravy or a glob of some dark jelly. Also, several strands of his hair stuck up defiantly in back, making me think of alfalfa in the old Little Rascals one-reelers. That almost made me burst out laughing. I was very nervous, remember, and I had to bite my lips to keep it in. "Yes, sir?" he asked as I approached the desk. All maitre d's in New York City have accents, but it is never one you can positively identify. A girl I dated in the mid-80s, one who did have a sense of humor, along with a fairly large drug habit, unfortunately, told me once that they all grew up on the same little island, and hence all spoke the same language. "What language is it?" I asked her. "Snooty," she said, and I cracked up. This thought came back to me as I looked past the desk to the woman I'd seen while outside. I was now almost positive it was Diane, and I had to bite the insides of my lips again. As a result, Humboldt's name came out of me sounding like a half-smothered sneeze. The maitre d's high, pale brow contracted in a frown. His eyes bored into mine. I had taken them for brown as I approached the desk, but now they looked black. "Pardon, sir?" he asked. It came out sounding to me like, "Fuck you, Jack." His long fingers, as pale as his brow, concert pianist fingers they looked like, tapped nervously on the cover of the menu, the tassel sticking out of it like some sort of half-assed bookmark swung back and forth. "Humboldt," I said, "party of three." I found I couldn't take my eyes off his bow tie, so crooked that the left side of it was almost brushing the shelf under his chin, and that blob on his snowy white dress shirt. Now that I was closer, it didn't look like either gravy or jelly. It looked like partially dried blood. He was looking down at his reservations book, the rogue tuft at the back of his head waving back and forth over the rest of his slicked down hair. I could see his scalp through the grooves his comb had laid down, and a speckle of dandruff on the shoulders of his tux. It occurred to me that a good head waiter might have fired an underling put together in such sloppy fashion. "Ah, yes, monsieur." He had found the name. "Your party is..." He was starting to look up. He stopped abruptly, and his eyes sharpened even more, if that was possible, as he looked past me and down. "You cannot bring that dog in here," he said sharply. "How many times have I told you you cannot bring that dog in here?" He didn't quite shout, but spoke so loudly that several of the diners closest to his pulpit-like desk stopped eating and looked around curiously. I looked around myself. He had been so emphatic that I expected to see somebody's dog, but there was no one behind me and most certainly no dog. It occurred to me then, I don't know why, that he was talking about my umbrella, that perhaps on the island of the maitre d's, dog was a slang term for umbrella, especially when carried by a patron on a day when rain did not look likely. I looked back at the maitre d' and saw that he had already started away from his desk, holding my menu in his hands. He must have sensed that I wasn't following, because he looked back over his shoulder, eyebrows slightly raised. There was nothing on his face now but polite inquiry. "Are you coming, monsieur?" And I came. I knew something was wrong with him, but I came. I could not take the time or effort to try and decide what might be wrong with the maitre d' of a restaurant where I had never been before today and where I would probably never be again. I had Humboldt and Diane to deal with. I had to do it without smoking, and the maitre d' of the Gotham Café would have to take care of his own problems, dog included. Diane turned around, and at first I saw nothing in her face and her eyes but a kind of frozen politeness. Then, just below it, I saw anger, or thought I did. We'd done a lot of arguing during our last 3 or 4 months together, but I couldn't recall ever seeing the sort of concealed anger I sensed in her now, anger that was meant to be hidden by the makeup and the new dress, blue, no speckles, no slit up the side, and the new hairdo. The heavy-set man she was with was saying something, and she reached out and touched his arm. As he turned toward me, beginning to get to his feet, I saw something else in her face. She was afraid of me, as well as angry at me. And although she hadn't said a single word, I was already furious at her. Everything on her face and in her eyes was negative. She might as well have been wearing a "closed until further notice" sign on her forehead. I thought I deserved better. Of course, that may just be a way of saying I'm human. "Monsieur," the maitre d' said, pulling out the chair to Diane's left. I barely heard him, and certainly any thought of his eccentric behavior and crooked bow tie had left my head. I think that even the subject of tobacco had briefly vacated my head for the first time since I'd quit smoking. I could only consider the careful composure of her face and marvel at how I could be angry at her and still want her so much it made me ache to look at her. Absence may or may not make the heart grow fonder, but it certainly freshens the eye. I also found time to wonder if I had really seen all I'd surmised. Anger? Yes, that was possible, even likely. If she hadn't been angry with me, to at least some degree, she never would have left me in the first place, I supposed. But afraid? Why in God's name would Diane be afraid of me? I'd never laid a single finger on her. Yes, I suppose I had raised my voice during some of our arguments, but so had she. "Mr. Davis, I'm Bill Humboldt," Diane's companion said. He held out a large hand that looked reddish and chapped. I shook it briefly. The rest of him was as big as his hand, and his broad face wore the sort of flush habitual drinkers often get after the first one of the day. I put him in his mid-40s, about 10 years away from the time when his sagging cheeks would turn into jowls. "Pleasure," I said, not thinking about what I was saying any more than I was thinking about the maitre d' with the blob on his shirt, only wanting to get the handshaking part over so I could turn back to the pretty blonde with the rose and cream complexion, the pale pink lips, and the trim, slim figure. The woman who had, not so long ago, liked to whisper, "Do me, do me, do me," in my ear, while she held onto my ass like a saddle with two pommels. "Where is Mr. Ring?" Humboldt asked, looking around. A bit theatrically, I thought. "Mr. Ring is on his way to Long Island. His mother fell downstairs and broke her hip." "Oh, wonderful," Humboldt said. He picked up the half-finished martini in front of him on the table and drained it until the olive with the toothpick in it rested against his lips. He spat it back, then set the glass down and looked at me. "And I bet I can guess what he told you." I heard this, but paid no attention. For the time being, Humboldt was no more important than minor static on a radio program you really want to hear. I looked at Diane instead. It was marvelous, really, how she looked smarter and prettier than previous. As if she had learned things, yes, even after only 2 weeks of separation and while living with Ernie and Dee Dee Coslaw in Pound Ridge, that I could never know. "How are you, Steve?" she asked. "Fine," I said. Then, "Not so fine, actually. I've missed you." Only watchful silence from the lady greeted this, those big blue-green eyes looking at me, no more. Certainly no return serve, no, "I've missed you, too." And I've quit smoking. That's also played hell with my peace of mind. "Did you finally? Good for you." I felt another flash of anger, this time a really ugly one, at her politely dismissive tone. As if I might not be telling the truth, but it didn't really matter if I was. She'd carped at me about the cigarettes every day for 2 years, it seemed. How they were going to give me cancer. How they were going to give her cancer. How she wouldn't even consider getting pregnant until I stopped. So I could just save any breath I might have been planning to waste on that subject. And now, all at once, it didn't matter anymore, because I didn't matter anymore. "We have a little business to transact," Humboldt said, "if you don't mind, that is." There was one of those big, boxy lawyer suitcases on the floor beside him. He picked it up with a grunt and set it on the chair where my lawyer would have been if his mother hadn't broken her hip. Humboldt began unsnapping the clasps, but I quit paying attention at that point. The fact was I did mind. It wasn't a matter of caution, either. It was a matter of priorities. I felt an instant's gratitude that Ring had been called away. It certainly clarified the issues. I looked at Diane and said, "I want to try again. Can we reconcile? Is there any chance of that?" The look of absolute horror on her face crashed hopes I hadn't even known I'd been holding on to. Instead of answering, she looked past me at Humboldt. "You said we didn't have to talk about this." Her voice was trembling, accusatory. "You said you wouldn't even let it come up." Humboldt looked a little flustered. He shrugged and glanced briefly down at his empty martini glass before looking back up at Diane. I think he was wishing he'd ordered a double. "I didn't know Mr. Davis would be attending this meeting without his lawyer. You should have called me, Mr. Davis. Since you did not, I feel it necessary to inform you that Diane did not greenlight this meeting with any thoughts of reconciliation in mind. Her decision to seek a divorce is final." He glanced at her briefly, seeking confirmation, and got it. She was nodding emphatically. Her cheeks were considerably brighter than they had been when I sat down, and it was not the sort of flush I associate with embarrassment. "You bet it is," she said, and I saw that furious look on her face again. "Diane, why?" I hated the plaintive note I heard in my voice, a sound almost like a sheep's bleat, but there wasn't a goddamn thing I could do about it. "Why?" "Oh, Jesus," she said, "are you telling me you really don't know?" "Yes." Her cheeks were brighter than ever, the flush now rising almost to her temples. "No, probably you don't. Isn't that typical?" She picked up her water and spilled the top 2 inches on the tablecloth because her hand was trembling. I flashed back at once, I mean kapow, to the day she'd left, remembering how I'd knocked the glass of orange juice onto the floor and how I'd cautioned myself not to try picking up the broken pieces of glass until my hands had settled down, and how I'd gone ahead anyway and cut myself for my pains. "Stop it. This is counterproductive," Humboldt said. He sounded like a playground monitor trying to stop a scuffle before it gets started, but his eyes were sweeping the rear part of the room, looking for our waiter, or any waiter whose eye he could catch. He was a lot less interested in us at that particular moment than he was in obtaining what the British like to call the other half. "I just want to know," I began. "What you want to know doesn't have anything to do with why we're here," Humboldt said, and for a moment he sounded as sharp and alert as he probably had been when he first strode out of law school with his diploma in his hand. "Yes, right, finally," Diane said. She spoke in a brittle, urgent voice. "Finally, it's not about what you want, what you need." "I don't know what that means, but I'm willing to listen," I said. "We could try counseling. I'm not against it if maybe..." She raised her hands to shoulder level, palms out. "Oh, God, Mr. Macho's gone New Age." Then she dropped her hands back into her lap. "After all the days you rode off into the sunset, tall in the saddle. Say it ain't so, Joe." "Stop it," Humboldt told her. He looked from his client to his client's soon-to-be ex-husband. It was going to happen all right. Even the slight unreality that comes with not smoking couldn't conceal that self-evident truth from me by that point. "One more word from either of you, and I'm going to declare this luncheon at an end." He gave us a small smile, one so obviously manufactured that I found it perversely endearing. "And we haven't even heard the specials yet." That, the first mention of food since I joined them, was just before the bad things started to happen. And I remember smelling salmon from one of the nearby tables. In the 2 weeks since I'd quit smoking, my sense of smell had become incredibly sharp, but I do not count that as much of a blessing, especially when it comes to salmon. I used to like it, but now I can't abide the smell of it, let alone the taste. To me it smells of pain and fear and blood and death. "He started it," Diane said sulkily. "You started it. You were the one who walked out," I thought, but I kept it to myself. Humboldt clearly meant what he said. He would take Diane by the hand and walk her out of the restaurant if we started that schoolyard. "No, I didn't. Yes, you did. Shit." Not even the prospect of another drink would hold him here. "Okay," I said mildly, and I had to work hard to achieve that mild tone, believe me. "I started it. What's next?" I knew, of course. Papers, papers, papers. And probably the only satisfaction I was going to get out of this sorry situation was telling them that I wasn't going to sign any, or even look at any, on the advice of my lawyer. I glanced at Diane again, but she was looking down at her empty plate, and her hair hid her face. I felt a strong urge to grab her by the shoulders and shake her inside her new blue dress like a pebble inside of a gourd. "Do you think you're in this alone?" I would shout at her. "Do you think you're in this alone? Well, the Marlboro man has got news for you, sweetheart. You're a stubborn, self-indulgent little bit." "Mr. Davis?" Humboldt asked politely. I looked around at him. "There you are," he said. "I thought we'd lost you again." "Not at all," I said. "Good. Lovely." He had several sheafs of paper in his hands. They were held together by those paper clips that come in different colors, red, blue, yellow, purple. They went well with the impressionist drawings on the walls of the Gotham Cafe. It occurred to me that I had come abysmally unprepared for this meeting, and not just because my lawyer was on the 1224 to Babylon, either. Diane had her new dress. Humboldt had his Brinks truck of a briefcase, plus documents held together by color-coded paper clips. All I had was my new umbrella on a sunny day. I looked down at where it lay beside my chair, it never crossed my mind to check it, and saw there was still a price tag dangling from the handle. All at once, I felt like Minnie Pearl. "I have here a number of forms which will allow both you and Ms. Davis to remain financially mobile while assuring that neither of you will have unfair access to the funds you both worked so hard to accumulate," Humboldt said. "I also have preliminary court notifications which need to be signed by you and forms that will allow us to put your bonds and T-bills in an escrow account until your current situation is settled by the court." I opened my mouth to tell him I wasn't going to sign anything, and if that meant the meeting was over, so be it, but I didn't get out so much as a single word. Before I could, I was interrupted by the maitre d'. He was screaming as well as talking. It was as if he had a belly full of steam and a tea kettle whistle caught in his throat. "That dog! Eee! I told you time and time again about that dog! Eee! All that time I can't sleep! Eee! She say cut your face, that cunt! Eee! How you tease me! Eee! And now you bring that dog in here! Eee!" The room fell silent at once, of course. Diners looking up in astonishment from their meals or their conversations as the thin, pale, black-clad figure came stalking across the room with its face outthrust and its long, stork-like legs scissoring. The maitre d's bow tie had turned a full 90 degrees from its normal position, so it now looked like the hands of a clock indicating the hour of 6. It was me he was looking at, me he was approaching. I stared at him, feeling almost hypnotized. It was like one of those dreams where you discover that you haven't studied for the bar exam you're supposed to take, or that you're attending a White House dinner in your honor with no clothes on. And I might have stayed that way if Humboldt hadn't moved. I heard his chair scrape back and glanced at him. He was standing up, his napkin held loosely in one hand. He looked surprised, but he also looked furious. I suddenly realized 2 things, that he was drunk, quite drunk, in fact, and that he saw this as a smirch on both his hospitality and his competence. He had chosen the restaurant, after all, and now look, the master of ceremonies had gone bonkers. "Eee! I teach you! For the last time, I teach you!" "See here, you idiot," Humboldt said, turning to face him, and the maitre d' brought his left hand out from behind his back. In it was the largest butcher knife I have ever seen. It had to have been 2 feet long, with the top part of its cutting edge slightly belled, like a cutlass in an old pirate movie. "Look out!" I yelled at Humboldt, and at one of the tables against the wall, a skinny man in rimless spectacles screamed, ejecting a mouthful of chewed brown fragments of food under the tablecloth in front of him. Humboldt seemed to hear neither my yell or the other man's scream. He was frowning thunderously at the maitre d'. "You don't need to expect to see me in here again if this is the way," Humboldt began. "Eee! Eee!" the maitre d' screamed, and swung the butcher knife flat through the air. It made a kind of whickering sound, like a whispered sentence. The period was the sound of the blade burying itself in William Humboldt's right cheek. Blood exploded out of the wound in a furious spray of tiny droplets. They decorated the tablecloth in a fan-shaped stipplework, and I clearly saw, I will never forget it, 1 bright red drop fall into my water glass and then dive for the bottom with a pinkish filament like a tail stretching out behind it. It looked like a bloody tadpole. Humboldt's cheek snapped open, revealing his teeth. And as he clapped his hand to the gouting wound, I saw something pinkish-white lying on the shoulder of his charcoal-gray suit coat. It wasn't until the whole thing was over that I realized it must have been his earlobe. "Tell this in your ears!" the maitre d' screamed furiously at Diane's bleeding lawyer, who stood there with 1 hand clapped to his cheek. Except for the blood pouring over and between his fingers, Humboldt looked weirdly like Jack Benny doing one of his famous double takes. "Call this to your hateful tattletale friends of the street, you misery, eee, dog lover!" Now other people were screaming, mostly at the sight of the blood, I think. Humboldt was a big man, and he was bleeding like a stuck pig. I could hear it pattering on the floor like water from a broken pipe, and the front of his white shirt was now red. His tie, which had been red to start with, was now black. "Steve?" Diane said. "Stephen?" A man and a woman had been having lunch at the table behind her and slightly to her left. Now the man, about 30 and handsome in the way George Hamilton used to be, bolted to his feet and ran toward the front of the restaurant. "Troy, don't go without me," his date screamed, but Troy never looked back. He'd forgotten all about a library book he was supposed to return, it seemed, or maybe about how he'd promised to wax the car. If there had been a paralysis in the room, I can't actually say if there was or not, although I seem to have seen a great deal and to remember it all. That broke it. There were more screams and other people got up. Several tables were overturned, glasses and china shattered on the floor. I saw a man with his arm around the waist of his female companion hurry past behind the maitre d'. Her hand was clamped into his shoulder like a claw. For a moment her eyes met mine, and they were as empty as the eyes of a Greek bust. Her face was dead pale, hag-like with horror. All of this might have happened in 10 seconds, or maybe 20. I remember it like a series of photographs or film strips, but it has no timeline. Time ceased to exist for me at the moment Alfalfa the maitre d' brought his left hand out from behind his back and I saw the butcher knife. During that time, the man in the tuxedo continued to spew out a confusion of words in his special maitre d's language, the one that old girlfriend of mine had called snooty. Some of it really was a foreign language, some of it was English but completely without sense, and some of it was striking, almost haunting. Much of it I can't remember. What I can remember, I suppose I'll never forget. Humboldt staggered backward, still holding his lacerated cheek. The backs of his knees struck the seat of his chair, and he sat down heavily on it. He looks like someone who's just been told he's disinherited, I thought. He started to turn toward Diane and me, his eyes wide and shocked. I had time to see there were tears spilling out of them, and then the maitre d' wrapped both hands around the handle of the butcher knife and buried it in the center of Humboldt's head. It made a sound like someone whacking a pile of towels with a cane. "Boot!" Humboldt cried. I'm quite sure that's what his last word on planet Earth was. Boot. Then his weeping eyes rolled up to whites, and he slumped forward onto his plate, sweeping his own glassware off the table and onto the floor with one outflung hand. As this happened, the maitre d', all his hair sticking up in back now, not just some of it, pried the long knife out of his head. Blood sprayed out of the head wound in a kind of vertical curtain and splashed the front of Diane's dress. She raised her hands to her shoulders with the palms turned out once again, but this time it was in horror rather than exasperation. She shrieked and then clapped her blood-spattered hands to her face, over her eyes. The maitre d' paid no attention to her. Instead, he turned to me. "That dog of yours," he said, speaking in an almost conversational tone. He registered absolutely no interest in or even knowledge of the screaming, terrified people stampeding behind him toward the doors. His eyes were very large, very dark. They looked brown to me again, but there seemed to be black circles around the irises. "That dog of yours is so much rage. All the radio of Coney Island don't make up to that dog, you motherfucker." I had the umbrella in my hand, and the one thing I can't remember, no matter how hard I try, is when I grabbed it. I think it must have been while Humboldt was standing transfixed by the realization that his mouth had been expanded by 8 inches or so, but I simply can't remember. It was in my hand, though, the price tag sticking out of the bottom of my fist. And when the maitre d' bent forward as if bowing and ran the knife through the air at me, meaning, I think, to bury it in my throat, I raised it and brought it down on his wrist like an old-time teacher whacking an unruly pupil with his hickory stick. "Ud!" the maitre d' grunted as his hand was driven sharply down and the blade meant for my throat plowed through the soggy pinkish tablecloth instead. He held on, though, and pulled it back. If I'd tried to hit his knife hand again, I'm sure I would have missed, but I didn't. I swung at his face and fetched him an excellent lick, as excellent a lick as one can administer with an umbrella anyway, up the side of his head. And, as I did, the umbrella popped open like the visual punchline of a slapstick act. I didn't think it was funny, though. The bloom of the umbrella hid him from me completely as he staggered backward with his free hand flying up to the place where I'd hit him. And I didn't like not being able to see him. I grabbed Diane's wrist and yanked her to her feet. She came without a word, took a step toward me, then stumbled on her high heels and fell clumsily into my arms. I was aware of her breasts pushing against me and the warm, wet clamminess over them. "Eee! You boinker!" the maitre d' screamed. Or perhaps it was boinger, he called me. It probably doesn't matter. I know that. And yet, it quite often seems to me that it does. Late at night, the little questions haunt me as much as the big ones. You boinking bastard! All those radios! Hush do baba! Fuck Cousin Brucey! Fuck you! He started around the table toward us. The area behind him was completely empty now and looked like the aftermath of a brawl in a Western movie saloon. My umbrella was still lying on the table with the open top jutting off the far side, and the maitre d' bumped it with his hip. It fell off in front of him, and while he kicked it aside, I set Diane back on her feet and pulled her toward the far side of the room. The front door was no good. It was probably too far away in any case, but even if we could get there, it was still jammed tight with frightened, screaming people. If he wanted me, or both of us, he would have no trouble catching us and carving us like a couple of turkeys. Bugs! You bugs! Eee! So much for your dog, eh? So much for your barking dog! Make him stop, Diane screamed. Oh, Jesus, he's going to kill us both. Make him stop! I rot you, you abominations! Closer now. The umbrella hadn't held him up for long, that was for sure. I rot you all! I saw three doors, two of them facing each other, in a small alcove where there was also a pay telephone. Men's and women's rooms. No good. I dragged her toward the third door and shoved through it into a world of clean green tiles, strong fluorescent light, gleaming chrome, and steamy odors of food. The smell of salmon dominated. Humboldt had never gotten a chance to ask about the specials, but I thought I knew what at least one of them had been. A waiter was standing there with a loaded tray balanced on the flat of one hand, his mouth agape and his eyes wide. He looked like Gimple the Fool in that Isaac Singer story. What? He said, and then I shoved him aside. The tray went flying, with plates and glassware shattering against the wall. Hey! A man yelled. He was huge, wearing a white smock and a white chef's hat like a cloud. There was a red bandana around his neck, and in one hand he held a ladle that was dripping some sort of brown sauce. Hey! You can't come in here like that! We have to get out, I said. He's crazy. He's... An idea struck me then, a way of explaining without explaining, and I put my hand over Diane's left breast for a moment, on the soaked cloth of her dress. It was the last time I ever touched her intimately, and I don't know if it felt good or not. I held my hand out to the chef, showing him a palm streaked with Humboldt's blood. Good Christ, he said. Here, in at the back. At that instant, the door we'd come through burst open again and the maitre d' rolled in, eyes wild, hair sticking out everywhere like fur on a hedgehog that's tucked itself into a ball. He looked around, saw the waiter, dismissed him, saw me, and rushed at me. I bolted again, dragging Diane with me, shoving blindly at the soft-bellied bulk of the chef. We went past him, the front of Diane's dress leaving a smear of blood on the front of his tunic. I saw he wasn't coming with us, that he was turning toward the maitre d' instead, and wanted to warn him, wanted to tell him that wouldn't work, that it was the worst idea in the world and likely to be the last idea he ever had. But there was no time. Hey, the chef said. Hey, gee, what dis? There was a heavy thud that made me think of the sound of the knife burying itself in Humboldt's skull. And then the cook screamed. It had a watery sound. It was followed by a thick, wet splat that haunts my dreams. I don't know what it was, and I don't want to know. I yanked Diane down a narrow aisle between two stoves that baked a furious, dull heat out at us. There was a door at the end, locked shut by two heavy steel bolts. I reached for the top one and then heard Guy, the maitre d' from hell, coming after us, babbling. I wanted to keep at the bolt. Wanted to believe I could open the door and get us outside before he could get within sticking distance, but part of me, the part that was determined to live, knew better. I pushed Diane against the door, stepped in front of her in a protective maneuver that must go all the way back to the Ice Age, and faced him. He came running up the narrow aisle between the stoves, with the knife gripped in his left hand and raised above his head. His mouth was open and pulled back from a set of dingy, eroded teeth. Any hope of help I might have had from Gimple the Fool disappeared. He was cowering against the wall beside the door to the restaurant. His fingers were buried deep inside his mouth, and he looked more like the village idiot than ever. "Forgetful of me, you shouldn't have been," Gee screamed, sounding like Yoda in the Star Wars movies. "You're a hateful dog. Your loud music so disharmonious. Eee! How you ever?" There was a large pot on one of the front burners of the left-hand stove. I reached out for it and slapped it at him. It was over an hour before I realized how badly I'd burned my hand doing that. I had a palm full of blisters like little buns, and more blisters on my three middle fingers. The pot skidded off its burner and tipped over in midair, dousing ghee from the waist down with what looked like corn, rice, and maybe 2 gallons of boiling water. He screamed, staggered backward, and put the hand that wasn't holding the knife down on the other stove, almost directly into the blue-yellow gas flame underneath a skillet where mushrooms, which had been sautéing, were now turning to charcoal. He screamed again, this time in a register so high it hurt my ears, and held his hand up before his eyes, as if not able to believe it was connected to him. I looked to my right and saw a little nestle of cleaning equipment beside the door. Glass-X and Clorox and janitor in a drum on a shelf. A broom with a dustpan stuck on top of the handle like a hat, and a mop in a steel bucket with a squeegee on the side. As Gee came toward me again, holding the knife in the hand that wasn't red and swelling up like an inner tube, I grabbed the handle of the mop, used it to roll the bucket in front of me on its little casters, and then jabbed it out at him. Gee pulled back with his upper body but stood his ground. There was a peculiar twitching little smile on his lips. He looked like a dog who has forgotten, temporarily at least, how to snarl. He held the knife up in front of his face and made several mystic passes with it. The overhead fluorescence glimmered liquidly on the blade, where it wasn't caked with blood, that was. He didn't seem to feel any pain in his burned hand, or in his legs, although they had been doused with boiling water and his tuxedo pants were spackled with rice. "Rotten bugger!" Gee said, making his mystic passes. He was like a crusader preparing to go into battle. If that was, you could imagine a crusader in a rice-cake tux. "Kill you like I did your nasty barking dog!" "I don't have a dog," I said. "I can't have a dog. It's in the lease." I think it was the only thing I said to him during the whole nightmare, and I'm not entirely sure I did say it out loud. It might only have been a thought. Behind him, I could see the chef struggling to his feet. He had one hand wrapped around the handle of the kitchen's big refrigerator and the other clapped to his blood-stained tunic, which was torn open across the swelling of his stomach in a big purple grin. He was doing his best to hold his plumbing in, but it was a battle he was losing. One loop of intestines, shiny and bruise-colored, already hung out, resting against his left side like some awful watch chain. Gee feinted at me with his knife. I countered by shoving the mop bucket at him, and he drew back. I pulled it to me again and stood there with my hands wrapped around the wooden mop handle, ready to shove the bucket at him if he moved. Behind Gee, the cook had managed to get all the way up. Slowly, like an invalid in early recovery from a serious operation, he started working his way down the aisle toward Gimple the Fool. I wished him well. "Undo those bolts," I said to Diane. "What?" "The bolts on the door. Undo them." "I can't move," she said. She was crying so hard I could barely understand her. "You're crushing me." I moved forward a little to give her room. Gee bared his teeth at me, mock jabbed with the knife, then pulled it back, grinning his nervous, snarling little grin as I rolled the bucket at him again on its squeaky casters. "Bug-infested stinkpot," he said. He sounded like a man discussing the Mets' chances in the forthcoming campaign. "Let's see you play your radio this loud now, stinkpot. It gives you a change in your thinking, doesn't it? Boink!" He jabbed. I rolled. But this time, he didn't pull back as far, and I realized he was nerving himself up. He meant to go for it, and soon. I could feel Diane's breasts brush against my back as she gasped for breath. I'd given her room, but she hadn't turned around to work the bolts. She was just standing there. "Open the door," I told her, speaking out of the side of my mouth like a prison con. "Pull the goddamn bolts, Diane." "I can't," she sobbed. "I can't. I don't have any strength in my hands. Make him stop, Stephen. Don't stand there talking with him. Make him stop." She was driving me insane. I really thought she was. You turn around and pull those bolts, Diane, or I'll just stand aside and let... Eee! He screamed and charged, waving and stabbing with his knife. I slammed the mop bucket forward with all the force I could muster and swept his legs out from under him. He howled and brought the knife down in a long, desperate stroke. Any closer and it would have torn off the tip of my nose. Then he landed spraddled awkwardly on widespread knees, with his face just above the mop-squeezing gadget hung on the side of the bucket. Perfect. I drove the mop head into the nape of his neck. The strings draggled down over the shoulders of his black jacket like a witch wig. His face slammed into the squeegee. I bent, grabbed the handle with my free hand, and clamped it shut. Gee shrieked with pain, the sound muffled by the mop. "Pull those bolts!" I screamed at Diane. "Pull those bolts, you useless bitch! Pull!" Thud! Something hard and pointed slammed into my left buttock. I staggered forward with a yell, more surprise than pain, I think, although it did hurt. I went to one knee and lost my hold on the squeegee handle. Gee pulled back, slipping out from under the stringy head of the mop at the same time, breathing so loudly he sounded almost as if he were barking. It hadn't slowed him down much, though. He lashed out at me with the knife as soon as he was clear of the bucket. I pulled back, feeling the breeze as the blade cut the air beside my cheek. It was only as I scrambled up that I realized what had happened, what she had done. I snatched a quick glance over my shoulder at her. She stared back defiantly, her back pressed against the door. A crazy thought came to me. She wanted me to get killed, had perhaps even planned it, the whole thing, found herself a crazy maitre d' and... Her eyes widened. Look out! I turned back just in time to see him lunging at me. The sides of his face were bright red, except for the big white spots made by the drain holes in the squeegee. I rammed the mop head at him, aiming for the throat and getting his chest instead. I stopped his charge and actually knocked him backward a step. What happened then was only luck. He slipped in water from the overturned bucket and went down hard, slamming his head on the tiles. Not thinking and just vaguely aware that I was screaming, I snatched up the skillet of mushrooms from the stove and brought it down on his upturned face as hard as I could. There was a muffled thump, followed by a horrible but mercifully brief hissing sound as the skin of his cheeks and forehead boiled. I turned, shoved Diane aside, and drew the bolts holding the door shut. I opened the door, and sunlight hit me like a hammer, and the smell of the air. I can't remember air ever smelling better, not even when I was a kid, and it was the first day of summer vacation. I grabbed Diane's arm and pulled her out into a narrow alley lined with padlocked trash bins. At the far end of this narrow stone slip, like a vision of heaven, was 53rd Street, with traffic going heedlessly back and forth. I looked over my shoulder and through the open kitchen door. Gee lay on his back with carbonized mushrooms circling his head like an existential diadem. The skillet had slid off to one side, revealing a face that was red and swelling with blisters. One of his eyes was open, but it looked unseeingly up at the fluorescent lights. Behind him, the kitchen was empty. There was a pool of blood on the floor and bloody handprints on the white enamel front of the walk-in fridge, but both the chef and Gimple the Fool were gone. I slammed the door shut and pointed down the alley. Go on. She didn't move, only looked at me. I shoved her lightly on her left shoulder. Go! She raised a hand like a traffic cop, shook her head, then pointed a finger at me. Don't you touch me! What'll you do, sick your lawyer on me? I think he's dead, sweetheart. Don't you patronize me like that. Don't you dare, and don't you touch me, Stephen. I'm warning you. The kitchen door burst open. Moving, not thinking, but just moving, I slammed it shut again. I leaned my back against it and braced my feet. Do you want to stand here and discuss it? I asked her. He's still pretty lively by the sound. He hit the door again. I rocked with it, then slammed it shut. I waited for him to try again, but he didn't. Diane gave me a long look, glary and uncertain, and then started walking up the alleyway with her head down and her hair hanging at the sides of her neck. I stood with my back against the door until she got about 3/4 of the way to the street, then stood away from it, watching it warily. No one came out, but I decided that wasn't going to guarantee any peace of mind. I dragged one of the trash bins in front of the door, then set off after Diane, jogging. When I got to the mouth of the alley, she wasn't there anymore. I looked right toward Madison and didn't see her. I looked left, and there she was, wandering slowly across 53rd on a diagonal, her head still down and her hair still hanging like curtains at the sides of her face. No one paid any attention to her. The people in front of the Gotham Cafe were gawking through the plate glass windows like people in front of the New England Aquarium shark tank at feeding time. Sirens were approaching, a lot of them. I went across the street, reached for her shoulder, thought better of it. I settled for calling her name instead. She turned around, her eyes dulled with horror and shock. The front of her dress had turned into a grisly purple bib. She stank of blood and spent adrenaline. "Leave me alone," she said. "I never want to see you again, Stephen." "You kicked my ass in there," I said. "You kicked my ass and almost got me killed. Both of us. I can't believe you, Diane." "I've wanted to kick your ass for the last 14 months, she said. "When it comes to fulfilling our dreams, we can't always pick our times, can we?" I slapped her across the face. I didn't think about it, I just did it, and few things in my adult life have given me so much pleasure. I'm ashamed of that, but I've come too far in this story to tell a lie, even one of omission. Her head rocked back. Her eyes widened in shock and pain, losing that dull, traumatized look. "You bastard!" she cried, her hand going to her cheek. Now tears were brimming in her eyes. "Oh, you bastard!" "I saved your life," I said. "Don't you realize that? Doesn't that get through? I saved your fucking life!" "You son of a bitch," she whispered. "You controlling, judgmental, small-minded, conceited, complacent son of a bitch. I hate you!" "Did you even hear me? If it wasn't for the conceited, small-minded son of a bitch, you'd be dead now. If it wasn't for you, I wouldn't have been there in the first place," she said, as the first three police cars came screaming down 53rd Street and pulled up in front of the Gotham Cafe. Cops poured out of them like clowns in a circus act. "If you ever touch me again, I'll scratch your eyes out, Steve," she said. "Stay away from me." I had to put my hands in my armpits. They wanted to kill her, to reach out and wrap themselves around her neck and just kill her. She walked 7 or 8 steps, then turned back to me. She was smiling. It was a terrible smile, more awful than any expression I had seen on the face of Guy, the demon waiter. "I had lovers," she said, smiling her terrible smile. She was lying. The lie was all over her face. But that didn't make the lie hurt any less. She wished it was true. That was all over her face, too. "Three of them over the last year or so. You weren't any good at it, so I found men who were." She turned and walked down the street, like a woman who is 65 instead of 27. I stood and watched her. Just before she reached the corner, I shouted it again. It was the one thing I couldn't get past. It was stuck in my throat like a chicken bone. "I saved your life! Your goddamn life!" She paused at the corner and turned back to me. The terrible smile was still on her face. "No," she said. "You didn't." Then she went on around the corner. I haven't seen her since, although I suppose I will. I'll see her in court, as the saying goes. I found a market on the next block and bought a package of Marlboros. When I got back to the corner of Madison and 53rd, 53rd had been blocked off with those blue sawhorses the cops used to protect crime scenes and parade routes. I could see the restaurant, though. I could see it just fine. I sat down on the curb, lit a cigarette, and observed developments. 6 rescue vehicles arrived, a scream of ambulances, I guess you could say. The chef went into the first one, unconscious but apparently still alive. His brief appearance before his fans on 53rd Street was followed by a body bag on a stretcher, Humboldt. Next came Guy, strapped tightly to a stretcher and staring wildly around as he was loaded into the back of an ambulance. I thought that for just a moment his eyes met mine, but that was probably just my imagination. As Guy's ambulance pulled away, rolling through a hole in the sawhorse barricade provided by two uniformed cops, I tossed the cigarette I'd been smoking in the gutter. I hadn't gone through this day just to start killing myself with tobacco again, I decided. I looked after the departing ambulance and tried to imagine the man inside it, living wherever maitre d's live. Queens or Brooklyn, or maybe even Rye or Mamaroneck. I tried to imagine what his own dining room might look like, what pictures might be on the walls. I couldn't do that, but I found I could imagine his bedroom with relative ease, although not whether he shared it with a woman. I could see him lying awake, but perfectly still, looking up at the ceiling in the small hours, while the moon hung in the black firmament like the half-lidded eye of a corpse. I could imagine him lying there and listening to the neighbor's dog bark steadily and monotonously, going on and on until the sound was like a silver nail driving into his brain. I imagined him lying not far from a closet filled with tuxedos and plastic dry cleaning bags. I could see them hanging there in the dark like executed felons. I wondered if he did have a wife. If so, had he killed her before coming to work? I thought of the blob on his shirt and decided it was a possibility. I also wondered about the neighbor's dog, the one that wouldn't shut up, and the neighbor's family. But mostly it was Guy I thought about, lying sleepless through all the same nights I had lain sleepless, listening to the dog next door or down the street as I had listened to sirens and the rumble of trucks heading downtown. I thought of him lying there and looking up at the shadows the moon had tacked to the ceiling. Thought of that cry, yee, building up in his head like gas in a closed room. Yee, I said, just to see how it sounded. I dropped the package of Marlboros into the gutter and began stamping it methodically as I sat there on the curb. Yee, yee, yee. One of the cops standing by the sawhorses looked over at me. Hey, buddy, want to stop being a pain in the butt? He called over. We got us a situation here. Of course you do, I thought. Don't we all? I didn't say anything, though. I stopped stamping. The cigarette pack was pretty well flattened by then anyway, and stopped making the noise. I could still hear it in my head, though, and why not? It makes as much sense as anything else. Eee. Eee.
That feeling, you can only say what it is in French. Read by Becky Ann Baker.
Floyd, what's that over there? Oh, shit! The man's voice speaking these words was vaguely familiar, but the words themselves were just a disconnected snip of dialogue. The kind of thing you heard when you were channel surfing with the remote. There was no one named Floyd in her life. Still, that was the start. Even before she saw the little girl in the red pinafore, there were those disconnected words. But it was the little girl who brought it on strong. "Uh-oh, I'm getting that feeling," Carol said. The girl in the pinafore was in front of a country market called Carson's. Beer, wine, groceries, fresh bait, lottery. Crouched down with her butt between her ankles and the bright red apron dress tucked between her thighs, playing with a doll. The doll was yellow-haired and dirty, the kind that's round and stuffed and boneless in the body. "What feeling?" Bill asked. "You know, the one you can only say what it is in French. Help me here." "Déjà vu," he said. "That's it," she said, and turned to look at the little girl one more time. "She'll have the doll by one leg," Carol thought, holding it upside down by one leg with its grimy yellow hair hanging down. But the little girl had abandoned the doll on the store's splintery gray steps and had gone over to look at a dog caged up in the back of a station wagon. Then Bill and Carol Shelton went around a curve in the road, and the store was out of sight. "How much farther?" Carol asked. Bill looked at her with one eyebrow raised and his mouth dimpled at one corner. Left eyebrow, right dimple, always the same. The look that said, "You think I'm amused, but I'm really irritated. For the 90 trillionth or so time in the marriage, I'm really irritated. You don't know that, though, because you can only see about 2 inches into me, and then your vision fails." But she had better vision than he realized. It was one of the secrets of the marriage. Probably he had a few secrets of his own, and there were, of course, the ones they kept together. "I don't know," he said. "I've never been here. But you're sure we're on the right road?" "Once you get over the causeway and onto Sanibel Island, there's only one," he said. "It goes across to Captiva, and there it ends. But before it does, we'll come to Palm House. That, I promise you." The arch in his eyebrow began to flatten. The dimple began to fill in. He was returning to what she thought of as the Great Level. She had come to dislike the Great Level, too, but not as much as the eyebrow and the dimple, or his sarcastic way of saying, "Excuse me?" when you said something he considered stupid, or his habit of pooching out his lower lip when he wanted to appear thoughtful and deliberative. "Bill?" "Do you know anyone named Floyd?" "There was Floyd Denning. He and I ran the downstairs snack bar at Christ the Redeemer in our senior year. I told you about him, didn't I? He stole the Coke money one Friday and spent the weekend in New York with his girlfriend. They suspended him and expelled her. What made you think of him?" "I don't know," she said. Easier than telling him that the Floyd with whom Bill had gone to high school wasn't the Floyd the voice in her head was speaking to. At least she didn't think it was. Second honeymoon. That's what you call this, she thought, looking at the palms that lined Highway 867, a white bird that stalked along the shoulder like an angry preacher, and a sign that read, "Seminole Wildlife Park. Bring a carful for $10. Florida, the sunshine state. Florida, the hospitality state. Not to mention Florida, the second honeymoon state. Florida, where Bill Shelton and Carol Shelton, the former Carol O'Neill of Lynn, Massachusetts, came on their first honeymoon 25 years before. Only that was on the other side, the Atlantic side, at a little cabin colony, and there were cockroaches in the bureau drawers. He couldn't stop touching me. That was all right, though, in those days. I wanted to be touched. Hell, I wanted to be torched like Atlanta and Gone with the Wind. And he torched me, rebuilt me, torched me again. Now it's silver. 25 is silver. And sometimes I get that feeling." They were approaching a curve, and she thought, 3 crosses on the right side of the road. 2 small ones flanking a bigger one. The small ones are clapped together wood. The one in the middle is white birch, with a picture on it, a tiny photograph of the 17-year-old boy who lost control of his car on this curve one drunk night. That was his last drunk night, and this is where his girlfriend and her girlfriends marked the spot. Bill drove around the curve. A pair of black crows, plump and shiny, lifted off from something pasted to the macadam in a splat of blood. The birds had eaten so well that Carol wasn't sure they were going to get out of the way until they did. There were no crosses, not on the left, not on the right. Just roadkill in the middle, a woodchuck or something, now passing beneath a luxury car that had never been north of the Mason-Dixon line. Floyd, what's that over there? What's wrong? Huh? She looked at him bewildered, feeling a little wild. You're sitting bolt upright. Got a cramp in your back? Just a slight one. She settled back by degrees. I had that feeling again, the deja vu.
Is it gone?
Yes, she said, but she was lying. It had retreated a little, but that was all. She'd had this before, but never so continuously. It came up and went down, but it didn't go away. She'd been aware of it ever since that thing about Floyd started knocking around in her head, and then the little girl in the red pinafore. But really, hadn't she felt something before either of those things? Hadn't it actually started when they came down the steps of the Lear 35 into the hammering heat of the Fort Myers sunshine? Or even before, en route from Boston? They were coming to an intersection. Overhead was a flashing yellow light, and she thought, to the right is a used car lot and a sign for the Sanibel Community Theater. Then she thought, no, it'll be like the crosses that weren't there. It's a strong feeling, but a false feeling. Here was the intersection. On the right, there was a used car lot, Palmdale Motors. Carol felt a real jump at that, a stab of something sharper than disquiet. She told herself to quit being stupid. There had to be car lots all over Florida, and if you predicted one at every intersection, sooner or later the law of averages made you a profit. It was a trick mediums had been using for hundreds of years. Besides, there's no theater sign. But there was another sign. It was Mary, the Mother of God, the ghost of all her childhood days, holding out her hands the way she did on the medallion Carol's grandmother had given her for her 10th birthday. Her grandmother had pressed it into her hand and looped the chain around her finger, saying, "Wear her always as you grow, because all the hard days are coming." She had worn it all right. At Our Lady of Angels Grammar and middle schools she had worn it, then at St. Vincent de Paul High. She wore the medal until breasts grew around it like ordinary miracles, and then someplace, probably on the class trip to Hampton Beach, she had lost it. Coming home on the bus, she had tongue-kissed for the first time. Butch Soucy had been the boy, and she'd been able to taste the cotton candy he'd eaten. Mary on that long-gone medallion and Mary on this billboard had exactly the same look, the one that made you feel guilty of thinking impure thoughts, even when all you were thinking about was a peanut butter sandwich. Beneath Mary, the sign said, "Mother of Mercy Charities, help the Florida homeless. Won't you help us?" "Hey there, Mary, what's the story?" More than one voice this time, many voices, girls' voices, chanting ghost voices. These were ordinary miracles. There were also ordinary ghosts. You found these things out as you got older. "What's wrong with you?" She knew that voice as well as she did the eyebrow and dimple look. Bill's "I'm only pretending to be pissed" tone of voice, the one that meant he really was pissed, at least a little. "Nothing," she gave him the best smile she could manage. "You really don't seem like yourself. Maybe you shouldn't have slept on the plane." "You're probably right," she said, "and not just to be agreeable either. After all, how many women got a second honeymoon on Captiva Island for their 25th anniversary? Round trip on a chartered Learjet? 10 days at one of those places where your money was no good, at least until MasterCard coughed up the bill at the end of the month. And if you wanted a massage, a big Swedish babe would come and pummel you in your 6-room beach house." Things had been different at the start. Bill, whom she'd first met at a crosstown high school dance and then met again at college 3 years later, another ordinary miracle, had begun their married life working as a janitor because there were no openings in the computer industry. It was 1973, and computers were essentially going nowhere, and they were living in a grotty place in Revere, not on the beach, but close to it, and all night people kept going up the stairs to buy drugs from the two sallow creatures who lived in the apartment above them and listened endlessly to dopey records from the 60s. Carol used to lie awake waiting for the shouting to start, thinking, "We won't ever get out of here. We'll grow old and die within earshot of Cream and Blue Cheer and the Dodgem cars down on the beach." Bill, exhausted at the end of his shift, would sleep through the noise lying on his side, sometimes with one hand on her hip, and when it wasn't there, she often put it there, especially if the creatures upstairs were arguing with their customers. Bill was all she had. Her parents had practically disowned her when she married him. He was a Catholic, but the wrong sort of Catholic. Graham had asked why she wanted to go with that boy when anyone could tell he was shanty. How could she fall for all his foolish talk? Why did she want to break her father's heart? And what could she say? It was a long distance from that place in Revere to a private jet soaring at 41,000 feet. A long way to this rental car, which was a Crown Victoria, what the good fellows in the gangster movies invariably called a Crown Vic, heading for 10 days in a place where the tab would probably be, well, she didn't even want to think about it. Floyd. Oh, shit. Carol, what is it now? Nothing, she said. Up ahead by the road was a little pink bungalow, the porch flanked by palms. Seeing those trees with their fringy heads lifted against the blue sky made her think of Japanese Zeros coming in low, their underwing machine guns firing. Such an association, clearly the result of a youth misspent in front of the TV. And as they passed, a black woman would come out. She would be drying her hands on a piece of pink toweling and would watch them expressionlessly as they passed. Rich folks in a Crown Vic headed for Captiva, and she'd have no idea that Carol Shelton once lay awake in a $90-a-month apartment, listening to the records and the drug deals upstairs, feeling something alive inside her. Something that made her think of a cigarette that had fallen down behind the drapes at a party, small and unseen, but smoldering away next to the fabric. "Hun?" "Nothing," I said. They passed the house. There was no woman. An old man, white, not black, sat in a rocking chair, watching them pass. There were rimless glasses on his nose, and a piece of ragged pink toweling, the same shade as the house, across his lap. "I'm fine now. Just anxious to get there and change into some shorts." His hand touched her hip, where he had so often touched her during those first days, and then crept a little farther inland. She thought about stopping him. Roman hands and Russian fingers, they used to say, and didn't. They were, after all, on their second honeymoon. Also, it would make that expression go away. "Maybe," he said, "we could take a pause, you know, after the dress comes off and before the shorts go on." "I think that's a lovely idea," she said, and put her hand over his, pressed both more tightly against her. Ahead was a sign that would read Palm House 3 miles on left, when they got close enough to see it. The sign actually read Palm House 2 miles on left. Beyond it was another sign, Mother Mary again, with her hands outstretched, and that little electric shimmy that wasn't quite a halo around her head. This version read, "Mother of Mercy Charities, help the Florida sick. Won't you help us?" Bill said, "The next one ought to say Burma Shave." She didn't understand what he meant, but it was clearly a joke, and so she smiled. The next one would say, "Mother of Mercy Charities help the Florida hungry," but she couldn't tell him that. Dear Bill. Dear in spite of his sometimes stupid expressions and his sometimes unclear allusions. "He'll most likely leave you, and you know something? If you go through with it, that's probably the best luck you can expect." This according to her father. Dear Bill, who had proved that just once, just that one crucial time, her judgment had been far better than her father's. She was still married to the man her Graham had called the big boaster, At a price, true. But what was that old axiom? God says, take what you want and pay for it. Her head itched. She scratched at it absently, watching for the next Mother of Mercy billboard. Horrible as it was to say, things had started turning around when she lost the baby. That was just before Bill got a job with Beach Computers out on Route 128. That was when the first winds of change in the industry began to blow. Lost the baby. Had a miscarriage. They all believed that, except maybe Bill. Certainly her family had believed it. Dad, Mom, Graham. Miscarriage was the story they told. Miscarriage was a Catholic story, if ever there was one. Hey, Mary, what's the story? They had sometimes sung when they skipped rope, feeling daring, feeling sinful, the skirts of their uniforms flipping up and down over their scabby knees. That was at Our Lady of Angels, where Sister Annunciata would spank your knuckles with her ruler if she caught you gazing out the window during sentence time. Where Sister Dormitilla would tell you that a million years was the first tick of eternity's endless clock, and you could spend eternity in hell. Most people did. It was easy. In hell, you would live forever with your skin on fire and your bones roasting. Now she was in Florida. Now she was in a Crown Vic sitting next to her husband, whose hand was still in her crotch. The dress would be wrinkled, but who cared if it got that look off his face? And why wouldn't the feeling stop? She thought of a mailbox with Raglan painted on the side and an American flag decal on the front, and although the name turned out to be Reagan and the flag a Grateful Dead sticker, the box was there. She thought of a small black dog trotting briskly along the other side of the road, its head down, sniffling, and the small black dog was there. She thought again of the billboard, and yes, there it was. Mother of Mercy Charities help the Florida hungry. Won't you help us? Bill was pointing. There, see? I think that's Palm House. No, not where the billboard is, the other side. Why did they let people put those things up out here anyway? I don't know. Her head itched. She scratched, and black dandruff began falling past her eyes. She looked at her fingers and was horrified to see dark smudges on the tips. It was as if someone had just taken her fingerprints. Bill? She raked her hand through her blonde hair, and this time the flakes were bigger. She saw they were not flakes of skin, but flakes of paper. There was a face on one, peering out of the char like a face peering out of a botched negative. Bill? What? What? Then a total change in his voice, and that frightened her more than the way the car swerved. Christ, honey, what's in your hair? The face appeared to be Mother Teresa's, or was that just because she'd been thinking about Our Lady of Angels? Carol plucked it from her dress, meaning to show it to Bill, and it crumpled between her fingers before she could. She turned to him and saw that his glasses were melted to his cheeks. One of his eyes had popped from its socket and then split like a grape pumped full of blood. And I knew it, she thought. Even before I turned, I knew it. Because I had that feeling. A bird was crying in the trees. On the billboard, Mary held out her hands. Carol tried to scream. Tried to scream. Carol? It was Bill's voice, coming from a thousand miles away. Then his hand, not pressing the folds of her dress into her crotch, but on her shoulder. You okay, babe? She opened her eyes to brilliant sunlight and her ears to the steady hum of the Learjet's engines. And something else, pressure against her eardrums. She looked from Bill's mildly concerned face to the dial below the temperature gauge in the cabin, and saw that it had wound down to 28,000. Landing? She said, sounding muzzy to herself. Already? It's fast, huh? Sounding pleased, as if he had flown it himself instead of only paying for it. Pilot says we'll be on the ground in Fort Myers in 20 minutes. You took a hell of a jump, girl.
I had a nightmare.
He laughed. The plummy, ain't you the silly Billy laugh she had come really to detest. No nightmares allowed on your second honeymoon, babe. What was it?
I don't remember, she said, and it was the truth. There were only fragments. Bill with his glasses melted all over his face, and one of the three or four forbidden skip rhymes they had sometimes chanted back in fifth and sixth grade. This one had gone, "Hey there, Mary, what's the story?" And then something, something, something. She couldn't come up with the rest. She could remember "Jangle, tangle, jingle, bingle, I saw Daddy's great big dingle," but she couldn't remember the one about Mary. "Mary helps the Florida sick," she thought, with no idea of what the thought meant. And just then there was a beep as the pilot turned the seatbelt light on. They had started their final descent. Let the wild rumpus start, she thought, and tightened her belt. "You really don't remember?" he asked, tightening his own. The little jet ran through a cloud filled with bumps. One of the pilots in the cockpit made a minor adjustment, and the ride smoothed out again. "Because usually, just after you wake up, you can still remember, even the bad ones." "I remember Sister Nunciata from Our Lady of Angels, sentence time." "Now that's a nightmare." 10 minutes later, the landing gear came down with a whine and a thump. 5 minutes after that, they landed. "They were supposed to bring the car right out to the plane," Bill said, already starting up the type A shit. This she didn't like, but at least she didn't detest it the way she detested the plummy laugh and his repertoire of patronizing looks. "I hope there hasn't been a hitch." There hasn't been, she thought, and the feeling swept over her full force. "I'm going to see it out the window on my side in just a second or two. It's your total Florida vacation car, a great big white goddamn Cadillac, or maybe it's a Lincoln." And yes, here it came, proving what? Well, she supposed it proved that sometimes when you had deja vu, what you thought was going to happen next really did. It wasn't a Caddy or a Lincoln after all, but a Crown Victoria, what the gangsters in a Martin Scorsese film would doubtless call a Crown Vic. "Whew," she said, as he helped her down the steps and off the plane. The hot sun made her feel dizzy. "What's wrong?" "Nothing, really. I've got deja vu, left over from my dream, I guess. We've been here before, that kind of thing." "It's being in a strange place, that's all," he said, and kissed her cheek. "Come on, let the wild rumpus start." They went to the car. Bill showed his driver's license to the young woman who had driven it out. Carol saw him check out the hem of her skirt, then sign the paper on her clipboard. She's going to drop it, Carol thought. The feeling was now so strong it was like being on an amusement park ride that goes just a little too fast. All at once you realize you're edging out of the land of fun and into the kingdom of nausea. She'll drop it, and Bill will say, "Whoopsie-daisy," and pick it up for her. Get an even closer look at her legs. But the Hertz woman didn't drop the clipboard. A white courtesy van had appeared to take her back to the Butler Aviation Terminal. She gave Bill a final smile, Carol, she had ignored completely, and opened the front passenger door. She stepped up, then slipped. "Whoopsie-daisy, don't be crazy," Bill said, and took her elbow, steadying her. She gave him a smile, he gave her well-turned legs a goodbye look, and Carol stood by the growing pile of their luggage and thought, "Hey there, Mary." "Mrs. Shelton?" It was the co-pilot. He had the last bag in the case with Bill's laptop inside it, and he looked concerned. "Are you all right? You're very pale." Bill heard and turned away from the departing white van, his face worried. If her strongest feelings about Bill were her only feelings about Bill, now that they were 25 years on, she would have left him when she found out about the secretary, a Clairol blonde too young to remember the Clairol slogan that started, "If I have only one life to live."